In a year of elections, the issue of immigration has dominated campaigns across Europe as far-right parties like the Alternative for Germany call for what they term mass remigration and make electoral gains by blaming every possible grievance on migrants and refugees. Those fleeing conflict and persecution face increased prejudice and greater challenges in restarting their lives. Today, we want to bypass the negative rhetoric and focus on how refugees are, in fact, an integral part of the solution to the problems faced by Western societies and their aging populations and growing dearth of skilled workers. We'll look at alternatives to humanitarian aid and ask how qualified refugees, from doctors and engineers to software developers, can be given the opportunity to work and rebuild their lives while benefiting their new home country. You're listening to the latest podcast from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, or SWP for short, here in Berlin. This is where we discuss what's on the minds of policymakers, or at the very least, what should be on their minds. I'm your host, Esme Nicholson, and to pick apart the policies both helping and preventing displaced people from truly picking up and moving on, I'm joined today by two experts, one from the field of research, the other from the field. Our first guest is SWP's very own Christina Korte, whose research focuses on immigration and refugee policies within the EU. Christina, it's great to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And joining us down the line from Italy, our second guest is Daniela Albanese from Talent Beyond Boundaries, an organisation that connects refugees with employers across the world. Daniela, thank you for joining us today and welcome.
Thank you.
So we're looking today at what are known in your line of work as complementary pathways, alternatives to the usual measures in place for people displaced by war and persecution. Christina, perhaps you could start by outlining the policies in place to help refugees resettle.
Yes. Well, to start with the usual measures in place, I'd say the most important option for refugees who are seeking protection in Europe is territorial asylum, which means that the people have to enter a state's territory or arrive at its borders in order to be able to apply for asylum. That's what we see every day in the media, people arriving by foot or by boat in Europe. However, on a global level, the vast majority of refugees does not move to Europe, but remains in countries near to their home country. For example, many people from Sudan moved to Egypt, fled to Egypt to seek protection there. And those neighboring countries, the countries of first asylum, are often middle or low-income countries. So resettlement now means that a country like Germany, for example, resettles a specific number of refugees from a country like, for example, Egypt, to come to Germany. This is a more safe and orderly way to access protection, but the problem with resettlement is that we are not talking about very big numbers here.
What kind of numbers are we talking about?
So, for example, in 2022, about 100,000 refugees were resettled worldwide. But the UNHCR estimated that about 2 million people were in need of resettlement. So there's a lack of slots offered here. This means that we need to increase resettlement quotas, but there's also a need for more option than just territorial asylum or resettlement. And this is why we discuss complementary pathways here, which go beyond the options I just mentioned. Now, there are several complementary pathways. The one that we would like to discuss here today is refugee labor mobility. Since there is a huge demand for labor in many European countries, and since refugees may well have the qualifications that are needed, it may be a win-win situation if these refugees move to Germany with a labor contract instead of applying for asylum, and with a status that would allow them to start working right away, which is not the case for people seeking asylum.
And Daniela, what can complementary pathways achieve that traditional humanitarian aid can't or doesn't?
I mean, the whole point is about, recognizing people's skills, competencies, work experience. What we are doing as Talent Beyond Boundaries, as the first organization that is working on labor mobility pathways across the world with different governments, is really to when a crisis happens, not to ask people what do you need, which is normally the question that the humanitarian agency typically ask, but who you are, what are your skills, what are your competencies, what can you bring to the society How can you, how, what are your dreams? I would say, how would you contribute to that? And this is exactly what complementary pathways can bring to the table. It's not only another humanitarian solution, it is really to recognize the competencies and skills of refugees as any other population in the world and leverage those skills to rebuild their life with future and purpose and dignity as well. So to allow regular and safe pathways for those people to come to Germany, to Europe in general, and be able to work.
So those are the aims. Can you tell me a little bit more about how Talent Beyond Boundaries then actually works? Maybe give us some examples of how exactly you're changing people's lives.
Yeah, what we did as Talent Beyond, what we do every day at Talent Beyond Boundaries, you describe me as a field worker, and we are a field worker. I mean, working on the ground every day in taking candidates, asking their profiles, their skills, their competencies, bringing them into what we call the Talent Catalog, which is a big database of a software that we use to make those talents visible to employers all over the world. We meet people like Amar, a senior corner engineer that is now relocating in London, because in the UK we have one of the biggest programs that could leverage his competencies in coding as a Java developer to go and move for work in the UK, as well as field technicians like Mohammed that is now that was previously in Lebanon, that we all know what is happening at the moment there with millions of refugees that are located there, and is now in Dublin in Ireland, in Europe, working as a field refugee in the fiber optics field to use their competencies that they and the work that they used to do before being forced to flee from their countries and to build their life with their families in the country of destination.
And I mean, your work actually sounds very logical. It sounds like a very simple, which I'm sure it's not, but simple solution to a problem. But tell us a little bit more about the difficulties, the challenges, what you need from governments, from companies in order to make this all work.
Yeah, the main issue, and I would say the whole concept of existence of Talent Beyond Boundaries is looking beyond the boundaries, beyond the barriers that we are facing every day to make regular movement and regular migration and realities for many refugees all over the world. Barriers that might be before departure, like the main is normally the passport lacking or documentation lacking for people that are forced to flee from their countries, that didn't have enough time or they don't have resources to go or possibility to go to their embassies or back to their country of origin to ask to the employers, for example, for their accreditation letter or for the passport for the countries of where they are escaping from, as well as financial barriers that they encounter in everyday life, challenges in the country or first asylum where they are. From the other side, at destination, we are seeing migration policies that are restricting every day more throughout the last 20 years, and the international workers in general, in even more refugees are facing problems and challenges to overcome these barriers, which are language barriers sometimes, there are documentation barriers, the timing of the programs that are normally sometimes very long, that are not suitable for the labor market.
Those are obviously some of the barriers, some of the bureaucratic barriers and perhaps political barriers. But Christina, perhaps you can tell us a bit more about what is actually happening or what needs to happen in terms of policy, particularly in Europe, for instance, in order to enable such a programme and to benefit both sides, both the refugees, the displaced people and companies desperate for skilled workers.
Yeah, I think what is going on at the moment is that we have different pilot programs in different countries, which is very interesting because each country has a different legal system and different migration policies. So it is interesting for us that we can observe those pilot programs and learn from them at the moment. Of course, there are several challenges because we are still quite at the beginning. One question is the question of scaling, of course. At the moment, we are still talking about quite small numbers of people. moving with those programs. So if the aim is scaling, then questions of financing or infrastructure will be we have to find solutions to those questions of financing and infrastructure. Then another very important issue, I think, is the issue of protection, because after all, the people we are talking about are refugees. So they are vulnerable in the sense they cannot return to their home countries. So in case, for example, a person loses her job or quits her job, what happens to this person? This may be a very rare case, but we still have to have a plan B in this case. Can the person apply for asylum or get a different visa? This is something that remains very important.
Well, if I may just interject briefly, Daniela, do you have experience of that happening? A refugee has got a job, say in Dublin or somewhere, and then at some point they may have lost their job. What happens in that instance?
We have a data that is very interesting for governments and employers, which is the 94% of retention rate after the first year of arrivals. That means that refugees normally stay at the same workplace where they came for the entry. And that is because, of course, of the resilience and the willingness of the people really to build their life again, and the gratitude that they have to the country of destination and also to the employer normally. The main point that we see all over the countries where we are working is that refugees, they don't want to be labeled as refugees. They want to be labeled as everyone else, as you label me with my profession and my name, with their profession and their names. So they want to be field engineer, they want to be technicians, they want to be bakers, they want to be in their profession, and that is what is astonishing every day, working with those people and their resilience that they have. Of course, we need to think about safe networks, but leveraging the skills of the people, it is the main insurance that we have really to make these programs work in the long term and at scale.
And perhaps I can bring you in, Christina, because, of course, skilled workers who happen to be refugees have families whose skills may not then also match where they may be going to. How then does a program like this, these complementary pathways, interact and work together with the more traditional asylum provisions?
Well, there is possibilities such as family reunification, of course. At the same time, it is always important to say that those are complementary pathways, of course, so it is not the idea to replace traditional asylum or any other pathways, because, as Daniela just said, many people have skills and are very happy and willing to arrive with a work contract, but there are also refugees who are very vulnerable, who are maybe traumatized, and who really need those protection measures. So this is the whole idea of complementary pathways, that we need different pathways and different options for all kinds of people.
And what about refugees who are not highly skilled or perhaps whose skills are not sought after? Are there schemes to support them in a similar way? Perhaps I can ask Daniela, but also then Christina to answer.
Yeah, in the talent catalog, we have 170 plus occupation registers. So that means that it goes from doctors and nurses, engineering to different occupation, even manual skills. Today, there is an employer in Amman that is selecting and testing Goldsmith experts, which is a real concrete and manual experience that they have, Syrians refugees in Jordan. So that means that the range of skills that we are seeing is very different. It can vary from high to low and medium skills. The main point is that starting from the needs of the employer, starting from that, it is the most powerful tool, and starting from the demand, because the employers need to find the candidates that are, of course, refugees from one side, but happen to be forced displacement, and that are professionals that can contribute to their business as well.
Christina.
Yes, I would say from a state perspective, and in Germany, for example, we, as in many European countries, we have labor shortages in areas such as IT, education, skilled crafts. but also in areas such as logistics, care or catering. So there's really a demand in very different fields and very different kinds of skills, let's say. And then, as I already said, for those whose skills are not sought after, we still need a protection system, because this labor refugee mobility is based on qualifications, on labor demand, of course, which makes sense. But we also need a system which is based on needs and on protection. So again, there's a need for those complementary pathways.
So as you say, the stress is on complementary, because safeguarding is still a very integral part of helping refugees and displaced people to move on. Daniela, we've already heard some of your success stories. Perhaps you could shed more light on where exactly in the world labour mobility programmes are underway and how these schemes are doing. I mean, where you've mentioned Dublin and London, but where else is this taking place?
Yeah, at the moment we are mainly working in Canada, UK and Australia, which are our biggest programs all over the world, starting to work in the US as well with the US government, as well as in different European countries like Italy, Spain, France, Ireland and Belgium that I've already mentioned, Germany and Slovakia. Of course, as you said, the word complementary, it is essential, and of course protection and safeguards, but we also need to see the reverse of the medals. So let's say, where are those people now? Those people are normally in first asylum countries, as we are seeing, unfortunately, in these days, thousands of people, of Syrian refugees in Lebanon, that are forced to flee back to their countries of origin because of the war happening there, that are not safeguarded where they are. They are half educated, they don't have the right to work, they don't have a right to permanent residences where they are, they cannot go back to their country of origin, they are stuck there. And as soon as we see protective crisis and humanitarian aid, that of course it is needed for those kind of crises, we are seeing like a protracted situation where people lose their skills that they have. What if we can just use those skills to move them out of displacement and fulfill the labor shortages that we have in Europe in this case?
Well, it sounds as if a lot of the countries where this is really fairly established are predominantly English-speaking countries, but obviously there are inroads into Europe. But that's a question perhaps for Christina about Germany. As we've mentioned, has a huge a need for skilled workers in many fields. Christina, what potential appetite is there for such programmes in Europe? Is the German government, for instance, actually interested in this programme? And what are the hurdles, perhaps? I'm thinking bureaucratic hurdles and political hurdles, once again.
Well, in Germany, no program for refugee labor mobility is in place so far. We are still at the beginning of the discussion. Maybe Daniela can say more about it. But Germany has, in the context of the Global Compact on Refugees, Germany has made a pledge to promote refugee labor mobility in Germany. So I think Germany is quite serious about this idea, and it is also an advantage that we can observe how pilot programs are going on in other countries and learn from them. There are hurdles, of course, of different actors being involved, and different actors have to work together in this case, because it's a kind of interference between labor migration and refugee protection. This is something new, but we can learn from what we are already seeing, what is going on. And I think it is not probable that Germany will develop specific new instruments for refugee labor mobility, because as Daniela already said, Germany has a quite liberal system for labor migration, so we can use the already existing legal framework and adapt them to use them for refugees as well.
And what about the issue, the additional hurdle, the additional barrier of language? Because again, you know, internationally, the first foreign language tends to be English.
Yeah, sure, that is an advantage for English-speaking countries, but we have a pilot program in Belgium, for example, so other non-English-speaking countries are already figuring this out. There is a possibility to propose language courses for refugees either on arrival or even before leaving their country of first asylum. So this is a problem, of course, but there are also solutions.
Of course, many displaced people don't come immediately from the country they've been displaced from. They are elsewhere, as Daniela has been talking about Syrian refugees in Lebanon, for instance. Could you, Christina, tell us maybe a little bit about those kind of hurdles and what some of the challenges when you have a large number of refugees, displaced people in a first country, and how easy it is for them to move on from there?
Yeah, I think this has not to be a hurdle, but this is something we have to keep in mind, that we really need a good cooperation with those countries of first asylum. A country, for example, such as Egypt, hosting many refugees from Sudan, may also wonder why we are sending those Sudanese refugees to Europe instead of our own citizens who might also be willing to move on to work in Europe. So I think, again, this is something that can be figured out, but we also have to keep in mind the interests of those countries and the role they play in this kind of programs.
Daniela, have you got any experience there on conflict of interest?
I mean, I wouldn't say that there is a conflict of interest for a couple of reasons. One is that normally, refugees are located in first asylum countries where they, as I mentioned, where they don't have the right to work or the right for a permanent residency. So normally, host countries are really willing to have a support from other countries to move out of displacement. And from the other side, when we are thinking about international migration or labor migration, Europe in particular has to think about that those people that are fleeing countries like Sudan, as she mentioned, might one day or another arrive illegally or irregularly into Europe anyway, if they don't find solutions where they are. And if they lack durable solution where they are, of course, they might be available to take other routes to come. So implementing regular and safe channels of entry, it is in the interest of Europe as well in this sense.
Of course, there's a lot of negative rhetoric, as we mentioned, in Europe right now and elsewhere, that focuses on migration, immigration being a problem. And Christina, I'm guessing that's actually very obvious to governments such as the German government when it comes to thinking about using complementary pathways, that there is obviously a huge advantage when it comes to communications and when it comes to rhetoric. But are they already thinking along those lines? This is a way to actually turn around the narrative.
Well, I think at the moment there are many calls for more safe and orderly migration. At the same time, the system that is in place at the moment for asylum seekers is that, as I said in the beginning, people have to arrive on a state's territory in order to apply for asylum. So, and then people have to wait a long time for their asylum claim to be solved. And in this time, they are not allowed to work. So I think it is interesting to think about those kind of pathways, which are safe and orderly, in fact, and which allow people to start working right at the moment they arrive in a country. And this can also change. So narratives and policies have an influence on each other.
Well, we're nearly out of time for today, so I'd like to thank our guests, Daniela Albanese and Christina Quarta. You'll find links to their work and projects in the podcast show notes. And if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also keep up to date with the latest analyses from SWP on X, formerly Twitter, and on LinkedIn. So until next time, it's goodbye from our guests.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, thank you.
And also from me, Esme Nicholson, thank you for tuning in.